Welcome to The Business of Medicine with Sharon Hollander. This is the show that reveals the behind-the-scenes secrets of healthcare. With the changing rules, regulations, and challenges facing healthcare, you can't afford to miss this information. Now, here's Sharon Hollander.
Good morning and welcome to the show. We're back for another exciting episode of Talk Zone and the Business of Medicine. And today I have a very exciting guest. Her name is Erin Havel, and she is not only a Twitter phenomenon, but she's also has personal experience with her own healthcare issues and navigating the insurance marketplace. We are live today, so if anybody has any questions or would like to join our conversation, our phone number is area code 888-463-6748. Once again, that number is 888-463-6748. And we welcome your call, your input. And so before we spend any more time, let's welcome Erin. Good morning, Erin.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on the show.
Thanks for being a guest. So I mentioned that you had some personal health issues yourself, and I failed to mention that you're also an author and a healthcare advocate. So I want to get into some of the issues that you personally went through that inspired you to write your book.
Sure. I was originally born with an arteriovenous malformation, an AVM. Only 1% of the population has that. And usually when we hear about it as lay people just watching the news, we usually hear about brain aneurysm. It's essentially right. The same thing. It's a bunch of blood vessels that just go crazy and look like spaghetti in your brain. But mine happened to be in my neck and then in my side. And they found it when I was little. There was an external one. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you, is that whether you found out, like, you knew about it. So it's like you knew about it long before you had an issue with it, right?
Yeah, well, I was born with it, and the doctors didn't know what it was. And so, you know, it was, 1977 when I was born, so medicine wasn't exactly where it is now. So I actually, it looked like a Victorian shoe is what I like to call it. It was this outside purpley red.
It was outside your skin?
Yeah, there was one that was outside my skin on my right-hand side, on my torso, and whenever I would rub against it as I got older, you know, it would bleed. So it became a real problem. I mean, I think the first memory I really have of it, you know, consciously was being in first grade, and I think I was watching a dinosaur movie, and then when I woke up, because I must have, you know, gone out from a bleed, my teacher was holding me, and I had this big bloody T-shirt. You know, so it needed to be taken care of. And so at the time, the doctors decided they were going to cut it off. We went to a
surgeon.
For, like, faces. Yeah, he was like a cosmetic
plastic
surgeon.
Yeah.
And so he was going to just cut it off. But with these kinds of things, what they didn't know is that if you cut into something like that, where there was one vessel, there becomes like six vessels, it's like those mythical creatures, you know, you chop off one head and six heads grow out of the stump. So that's really how this all began, was because of this vascular malformation. And, it's something that I lived with. You know, the doctors didn't really know how to treat it, so they just said, well, watch it. And then when I got into like middle school, I swelled up really bad. My side swelled up, and they didn't, I think it was a CAT scan. That was the, you know, latest technology, right? And they saw that it was this big mass in my side, and they said, well, she might die. We don't know what to do with this. You know, keep watching it. So I just went on the rest of my life watching this thing. And, you know, it wasn't until after I graduated college, I was like 26, when MRIs really were more popular and readily used. And so I was having these jabbing back pains, and I went into my regular doctor. He sent me for an MRI, and they said, oh, it's a vascular malformation. We know what this is. There's this specialist down in Denver. You should go see him. And what had happened was because they, you know, cut into an internal version of what the external AVM was. They didn't know they had done that. But that's why it had grown so out of control, and it grew into my back muscles and was starting to corrupt them, and that's why I was having pain.
Wow.
So I started treatment. I know, crazy, right?
It's crazy, right?
I started treatment on that when I was 26, and it was the second largest that the doctor had ever seen. And he was, you know, the only specialist in the country at the time. So I thought that was saying something. Yeah. And he began monthly injections of ethanol. So they were ethanol embolizations. So he had to go into each individual vessel to kill them off. And that took, I think it was 5 or 6 years of going in every month for back-to-back surgeries. It was pretty darn rough. And then I had to fight with my insurance company because they started paying it. And then they all of a sudden decided to stop paying my doctor. And that was my first initiation into, wait a minute, if you have health insurance and you get sick, they don't always cover stuff. You know?
I mean, yeah, surprise, right?
I was naive. I was young yet. I mean, I was just off my parents' insurance. So, you know, prior to all of this, if I got sick, my parents took care of it. I never had to think about it. But then here I was, this young adult, now like battling for my life.
Well, you know, it's interesting. One of the things that you said, and, you know, the doctors, like the way they were, you know, 20 years ago, like their answer to everything was, oh, she could die, you know?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
They didn't even say, okay, let's try to figure out what's wrong with her. And it's like, she could die.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and I can't blame them because, I mean, it is kind of rare in the first place, 1%, come on. But, yeah. You know, it's still, that's a scary thing for an early teenager to hear. You know, what do you mean I'm going to die? What does that mean? You know, I'm glad I'm
laughing,
here.
Yeah, I'm glad you didn't die. It would be dead air on the air.
Right.
No, but like it's, you know, the thing too is, I don't know, like I've heard the only experience I know about AVMs, you know, it's a couple times they had it featured on a TV show. It was either House or ER or something, you know.
Yeah.
And they love to just use medical jargon and say, oh, you know.
Right. Yeah. AVMs, I mean, there's so much more research now, and it seems like, you know, there's not just the one doctor who discovered the ethanol treatment, you know what I mean? Now there's other doctors that are around, I've found out recently. But, you know, for a while there, you know, we had the internet, sure, but you'd go online and you'd type in AVM and it would say, you know, the medical jargon for it, but there wouldn't be any support groups or anyone else who had one, and it would be so random if you'd meet someone that did have it. And so that's hard. That's a hard place to be for anybody because you want to be able to talk about what you're experiencing. And if there's so few people and there's not much of a network, it's difficult. You don't know who to go see. You don't know who to go talk to. And that was probably a good thing for me because as soon as I was able to say, hey, I found this doctor and I'm getting the treatment, then, you know, with the internet burgeoning, I was able to give that information to other people whose kids all of a sudden were, you know, born and had these weird masses on them and they didn't know how to treat them. I'm like, hey,
right.
Go see this guy, you know?
Yeah, that's great. I mean, that's like, do you think that there's a cause for it or do they know what it is, the cause?
No, well, when the fetus is developing in the womb, you know, extra blood vessels come to the body so that the gestational period, you know, everything is created and the body looks good. But for people with AVMs, what happens is the blood vessels, the extra blood vessels, after they're done doing their job, they don't stop doing their job. They just continue to go on. For normal people, those extra blood vessels will die off because their job is finished. But it's like it's some kind of glitch in the system. That's the only way I can describe it. And the blood vessels just continue to keep growing. And so they get all tangled up and become these masses. And, you know, I don't remember exactly like what blood test or whatever, but it's interesting because prior to knowing what this was, if I had gone in to just a regular emergency room thing, I wasn't feeling good and they took my blood, they would think I was having a heart attack all the time because that's what the kind of test results would show with an AVM if you didn't know what it was. Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. So did they tell you that you had a heart attack like when you were younger?
No, but it was when I was older, actually. They're like, you know, it's good that you're getting this taken care of now because if you went in, you know, sometime later on, they'd be very concerned about your heart. And I would never have thought about, you know, that connection or anything like that because, well, I was in my 20s, so I wouldn't have thought about heart attacks anyway. But
well, you think it was because the cardiac enzymes were up or just that it mimics symptoms of a heart attack?
I think it's probably just the blood numbers. I don't know. Like I said, I'm not too well versed in how blood tests work and what all they say. But it's one of the blood tests that they would normally do just as like a, hey, if she's not doing too well, we'll do a standard panel of blood tests. And it would show like, oh, she's, gosh, these are high. So therefore she must be having a heart attack.
Crazy.
Yeah.
So I want to get into a little bit about, okay, so let's talk about a little bit about the insurance issue. Before we get to that though, like initially when you said, okay, I'm going to go get treatment in Denver, I assume you weren't living in Denver at the time, right?
No, I was living in New Mexico. So Denver was actually pretty close, which was good.
Oh, okay. So you could drive there.
It was a 6-hour drive. Well, yeah. Yes and no. We tried that the first time I went in for treatment, and the ride home was really bad, you know, because it's anesthesia, they knock you out, and they do all these injections of ethanol. So you leave feeling pretty crappy. So driving 6 hours back home, that was not a pretty sight. So we decided the best bet. Oh, my gosh. It was horrible. So the flights that got expensive. You know, that's something that you don't think about either. You know, you're going to go for treatment with a doctor that may be under your health insurance policy, and you're like, great, but you don't think about the cost of actual travel to get to where you need to be. And because of the amount of AVM that they were dealing with, I needed to go every month for so many years. I think it was $375 a flight. And so to do that once a month, that got very expensive, along with the co-pays and the, you know, maximum out-of-pocket.
So, but your insurance would not pay for you to travel, even if it was the only doctor in the country that could provide the care, right?
Yeah, no, that was not part of my policy at all. We checked. We really checked everything. It was, you know, again, I was really stumbling through this because I was so young and I had never experienced anything like this before, where I had to really deal with a company to get the care that I needed. And I think that I probably didn't ask as many questions as I should have, but we did ask that one because I was like, how do I, you know, keep paying for this? I was doing pretty good as a young adult. I mean, I had a really decent job and I had a nice savings account. But within the first few years of, like I said, maximum out of pockets and co-pays and flights and all that junk, I think I ran through $20,000 of savings. I had nothing left. That was all I had. So it's really easy to lose everything all at once. And then with me, I was having all those treatments, and eventually I ended up with a wound that would not heal. And my doctor said, hey, look, you've got to stop working. So then you've got someone who has no money, and then now I'm going to have to stop working, so I'll have no income. I mean, that's a very scary place to be for anybody.
Right.
I went ahead and, I had to stop working. That was humiliating and very difficult for someone in their 20s because, you know, you're just starting out. You're like, hey, I'm finally getting someplace, and you're moving up the ladder.
I know. You get excited that you could actually buy a new pair of shoes with your own money.
Yeah. I mean, it's so great. And then all of a sudden someone goes, sorry, you might die again. You know, like all this, you might die. Like, that's very scary. So
I know, but like we all might die, you know?
Yeah.
I guess you can't live your life worrying about dying.
Right.
Anyway, it looks like we have to take a short break. But when we come back, I want to get more into the specifics about your insurance coverage. You're listening to Sharon Hollander on TalkZone.com.
Doctor, don't you whine, because your cash flow is now a flat line. You can make your income fast. Call 818-907-STAT.
For all your medical billing needs, visit us at www.statmedical.net or call 818-907-7828. That's
818-907-STAT.
Welcome back to the Business of Medicine on Talk Zone. Here's Sharon Hollander.
Hi, welcome back. We're live this morning in Encino, so if you have any questions or you'd like to join our conversation, the number to call in is area code 888-463-6748. Once again, that number is 888-463-6748. We're talking this morning with Erin Havel, who has a personal life story to share with us, and she was diagnosed with AVM, which is a arteriovenous malformation. And she's talking to us about her experience with receiving treatment. And also now we're going to get into the nitty gritty of what her experience has been with the healthcare and the insurance marketplace. So welcome back, Erin.
Thank you.
So before the break, we were talking a little bit about, we just touched on the fact that you had to leave your job and you had to seek treatment, you know, out of state, which was obviously costly for travel and expenses. So let's get into what happened with the insurance.
Yeah, so I had now left my job, and I was a year and a half into my treatment. And my insurance company, I always scheduled, pretty much came back, insurance was covering it. And I got I got back, I called, and I said my plan for, I think it was August or September of whatever year it was, I think maybe 2006. Either way, I called, and I said, okay, I need to, you know, schedule my appointment. And the people at my doctor's office said, we can't schedule because the insurance company is refusing to cover the last treatment. It was pre-approved. I'm like, so I gave her all the information. I'm like, here's the pre-authorization number. Here's everything. And they're like, yes, they have that, but they're still refusing to cover it. And so then it went on for a very long time where I would call each month because I'm supposed to be having these treatments to help me. And all of a sudden they've been cut off completely. And, they were arguing with the doctor back and forth, trying to come up with a new, I guess, a contract of some sort. And then finally, they removed him from the network. He was not going to give in to whatever demands they were trying to make. And so they just removed him from the network. And I was stuck going, well, wait a minute, where does that leave me? Because I can't cover these very expensive, you know, treatments out of pocket. And it was hard because I called the insurance company immediately and I'm like, look, this is the only guy that knows how to do this. What do I do? You know, where do I go? And they started to send me to all these different vascular surgeons that did not work with AVMs. And they had me have all of these extra tests that I didn't need. Like I went in for 3 or 4 different MRIs with different doctors because they wanted their own MRI. You know, so they're spending these massive amounts of money like to...
Right. Rediagnosing your testing.
Right.
But, you know, I just want to talk a little bit about the process of, you know, canceling him from the network, because that's a huge thing. I mean, my understanding is, I don't know about him specifically, you know, in his case, but, you know, typically a doctor will have a contract with the insurance company.
Yeah.
And in there, you know, there's a clause that basically says, you know, we have the right to terminate your agreement or whatever with, you know, X amount of days notice. It's just like any other contract, right? So the insurance company is in breach of contract if they just arbitrarily decide they're going to remove someone from a network.
Right. Yeah, I don't know all the ins and outs of it, but I know that they were working really hard to try to come up with a new agreement or whatever because, and I don't think it was just me. I'm pretty sure I heard later that there was some other like cases that were going on, you know, where people were having AVMs and trying to get them treated. And I think there was another guy in the state at the same time that was doing the same thing I was doing, and it was the same problem. So, you know, I don't know exactly what their negotiations were about. I wasn't in on it, but I know that he was all of a sudden out of my network, and I was forced to go find someone else who did not exist.
Wow.
Yeah, and it was hard because I'd go into these vascular surgeons and, you know, I tell them what was going on and they just roll their eyes and, you know, huff out some air and be like, well, you have to go back and see the guy that knows how to treat it. We don't treat this kind of stuff. And so then I'd have them write letters and we'd send them to the, you know, to the insurance company.
Say, yeah.
Look, you know, like even if he's not in network, no one in network treats this. What do we do?
Right.
And it was bad. It went on for 9 months where I was fighting with them and, you know, and I was physically and emotionally deteriorating very quickly because it's like batting your head against a brick wall. You know, you're constantly like, I'll jump through that hoop. Sure. Okay. Jump through that hoop. Well, here's another hoop and another hoop and another hoop. And ultimately there's nothing.
And then, at one point, like, so during the time that the insurance had denied, did you stop coverage or you kept doing it? Like you were getting sicker and sicker.
No, I had to stop. I couldn't go to the treatments. There was no way I could afford them at all. And I, you know, it was bad enough, like I said, you know, just trying to get there with the insurance coverage because those maximum out of pockets each year, you know, that'll eat away at you really quick. And my credit cards were looking pretty, you know, shabby after a while, you know.
Yeah. And then did you have any other like government resources? Did you have anybody like working on your behalf? Like, did you try going through the insurance commissioners or?
I called the insurance commissioner or whatever at the time, and I don't remember that they were able to do much. Like, they contacted the insurance company on my behalf, but I feel like, I don't know if it's probably different in every state, but I felt like New Mexico maybe wasn't as up on how to fix that. I mean, I don't want to throw New Mexico under the bus, but it's got a lot of repressed situations going on down there, and I don't know that it necessarily had the greatest pull.
Well, you know, we in California have a message on our insurance commissioner's telephone line that says, don't call us for claim disputes.
Great.
I had a guest in a previous show from the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. And so there's actually, they oversee all the insurance commissioners by state. So, I mean, I know that this doesn't, you know, there's really no bearing on it, but it's interesting how just the hierarchy of what you have to do sometimes when things get denied.
Right. Yeah, appeal after appeal after appeal. I finally ended up going to hire an attorney. And, you know, he looked at my policy and he's like, absolutely, you know, if there's no one else in network that can cover this, they are supposed to allow you to go out of network. It won't be, you know, covered as much, but...
Right.
You should be able to.
At least half, yeah.
Right.
Because then at least you'd get half of it covered.
Exactly. So we went to them with that, and we went to, I guess he was the plan administrator or whatever, talked to him, and I mean, we really went through everything, and finally, 10 days after my 30th birthday, I think it was my 30th birthday that I actually got the letter. So happy birthday to me. I get this letter saying, we're going to cover part of your treatment, and it definitely was not as much as it should have been, but at least I was like, okay, I can work with that. It's something I can work with. And I went in for the treatment, and they did the pre-blood work before the surgery, and that's when they found that my white blood cell count was 177,000. Normally, a white blood cell count is between 4,000 and 10,000, so there was something definitely wrong.
So they thought you had appendicitis or something, right?
They had no idea, but it was interesting because the lady that was the physician's assistant at the time, she had actually just come from an oncology ward. And so she was very, like, heightenedly aware of, uh-oh, this could be something serious. And they put me into the hospital. They, you know, it wasn't on my normal floor, and it wasn't the vascular area or anything like that. It was this random ward I'd never been in. And they did a bone marrow biopsy, and they discovered that I had chronic myelogenous leukemia. So now I've got these two conditions that I'm going to be trying to battle an insurance company over. And the medication for...
Now, do you think, I mean, were they related? Do you think it was related? Do you think it was related to the treatment? Or do you think it was unrelated?
You know what? I have my own opinions on this because no one can say for really sure. I personally think that we probably all have cancer cells in our body and something will trigger them to turn on. And I was under a tremendous amount of stress. I don't handle stress.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Like the stress of dealing with insurance companies, it'll just kick anything over the edge.
Yeah, I really wonder because everybody I've talked to, I mean, typically CML is a 65-year-old man's disease. Well, I'm a girl and I was 30. So, I mean, there are definitely young adults that get CML, but, you know, traditionally what it's been called over the years is it's this older man's disease. And so here I was with it. So I think I probably had those cells just waiting to pop off for some reason or another. And all that stress, I think, probably didn't help. And my immune system was weak because you figure I was having all those treatments constantly. And, you know, between both fighting and lowered immune system and all of that, I can't say for sure, but that's my own personal opinion.
Right.
But the medication for
it makes sense. I mean,
yeah, it cost originally, it was $3,000 a month. Now we're getting closer to when their patent is running out. And so the medication over the last 5 years has gone up from $3,000 to anywhere between $8,000 and $13,000 a month. And that's also another fight with insurance companies. So I'm kind of understanding how this insurance stuff is working. You know, they'll cover you as long as it's, you know, a finite amount of
cheap
time,
enough.
As long as it's, affordable. But
and then, so, but what happened with
illness,
the attorney? The attorney wasn't able to, like, take over the case and just...
I was actually in a weird place in my life where we were just getting ready to move for a fellowship. The person I was with was getting a fellowship out of state. And so he's like, you know, we can fight this. We can absolutely, I can take your money and we can fight this. And he's like, or we can accept what they've, you know, offered, and you can get onto a next insurance policy as soon as possible and start up again. So we accepted what they finally offered, which was, like I said, not as good as it should have been, but at least they were willing to cover some of it. That helped.
Right. And then, I mean, you're talking about, but like in most policies, they have a maximum out-of-pocket annual expense, right?
Right.
And then they're supposed to kick in and...
Yeah, the maximum out-of-pocket situation was not part of my situation. It wasn't like I had reached my maximum out-of-pocket with the policy. That wasn't it at all. It was just that they really did not want to cover this doctor. I think that it was an internal fight between them and the doctor, and I was the casualty.
Right. Do you think the doctor initiated the fight, or is just it was all about money? Was it something more than money, or you don't know?
Oh, I think it was all about money, because honestly, the doctor was working with them. You know, he's like, I will lower my costs. I will do this. I will do that. But they just stopped paying him. Like, he had done, I don't know how many treatments on me. And then all of a sudden to just stop paying him for the work he had already done. Like, that's shady.
Yeah.
And I think that's where
Although it happens every day.
Yeah.
It happens every day with insurance companies. And then you're faced with issues of getting new insurance with all these pre-existing conditions, right?
Right. Well, I was lucky because the next job was this fellowship, and I was allowed to be on that policy. So I was on that policy, and we started out, and they covered everything with the doctor in Denver beautifully. Like, they were no trouble at all. The problem I had with them was now covering the TKIs, their tyrokinase inhibitors. That's the chemotherapy that I will be on for the rest of my life daily for chronic myelogenous leukemia. And so here's this $3,000 at the time medication. And so every new year, what would happen is they'd send me a letter. They'd send me a 30-day supply, and then they'd send me a letter saying, we don't think that see if there's any other alternatives to this medication because it is so expensive. And you can send an appeal letter into us, and then we have 60 days to decide if you need to continue on this medication. Well, the funny thing about that is, okay, so great, I'm on a daily chemotherapy drug. Okay, you give me 30-day supply, and then you have another 60 days after I send my little appeal letter to you and my doctor gives them all the information to decide if I should be on this daily chemotherapy drug that I need to survive. So they have 60 days where that's basically 2 months of being able to, you know, save $3,000 each month. So even just the appeal process is a great way to stall so that way they don't have to cover me for
right.
a couple months.
And then what are you supposed to do in the interim while they're doing the appeal process? You're supposed to take the medication or not take the medication?
Well, I'm supposed to take it every day for the remainder of my life. So I you know, it's very stressful. And so I went through all of these different struggles of like, oh gosh, you know, how do I get the pills? And so, you know, thankfully, the medication that I'm on, the drug company, they had it's a 3 month, you know, interim, like just in case you're having problems, here's a 3 month supply. So I like harbored those 3 months, like you wouldn't believe. I held on to those pills, like I would take them, but it's very hard to adhere to what your treatment is when you're terrified that in a month or 2 months, you'll no longer have your medication. And
right.
that would happen every single year.
And then back to the sentence where, oh, you could die.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
Anyway, it looks like we have to take another short break, but we'll be back with Erin Havel in just a few moments.
And now, more of the Business of Medicine on TalkZone.com. Here's Sharon Hollander.
Good morning and welcome back. We're live this morning, so if you have any questions, you can join our conversation. And we're at area code 888-463-6748. We're talking to Erin Havel, who's giving us her blow-by-blow description of all the frustrations and issues that have come up with her own personal healthcare issues and fighting with the insurance companies. Before the break, you were talking a little bit, Erin, about, you know, being on medication and worrying from day to day whether or not the insurance was going to cover it, whether you're going to get stuck with these huge bills. As you know, my background is, you know, dealing with physicians and also dealing with insurance companies. So I totally understand some of the frustrations both the doctors go through, and the patients are basically the victims stuck in the middle when there's an issue where the insurance says they're not going to cover something, but it's obviously a medically necessary treatment. And so we were talking, that's been your experience, right?
Yeah, and I was thinking, you know, it's really hard on the doctors too, because most people get into medicine because they want to help people, and they're not really thinking about the logistics of insurance and how, you know, someone might stop a patient from being healed or cared for in the way that they are meant to be cared for. And so I always felt bad for the doctors that I was working with too, because, you know, they just look at this and shake their heads like, I want to help you and I am being told I can't. And that's a horrible place to be in.
Right. Except, I mean, you know, I don't know. Like, you have to look at the big picture, too. Like, there's got to be more agencies and more resources out there. Like, at some point, having a chronic disease, you didn't qualify for Medicare?
I did. I ultimately, when I had to stop working, I was put on I had a long-term disability policy, thankfully, through my company. And so I did that for a year, and during that time, you know, the long-term disability policy doesn't really want you on the policy. So what they do is they try to get you onto Social Security disability. And so they put all of the information out there for me. I didn't have to fight to get my Social Security disability. I guess I apparently got a denial, and then they went ahead and they sent more information, and they finally got me approved. But then it's 2 years once you're approved on Social Security before you get Medicare. So I was in a really precarious position for those 2 years with regular insurance through employment of this person I was with at the time. And you're really at the mercy of the insurance company. Once Medicare steps in, I was all of a sudden able to have copay assistance from certain organizations that work with Medicare. I wasn't eligible for that before, and that's been the greatest blessing in my life, because now all of a sudden, you know, with Medicare, there was that, I don't know if there still is, because now I have a little bit of a different insurance situation. But there was that loophole that, what do they call it? It's like $3,000-some-hundred before they cover any of these major medical costs with drug coverage. Right. And so you would pay that amount. But with the copay assistance, they would pay that amount. So I wouldn't have to come up with $4,000 out of pocket initially just to then go ahead and get my first month of medication for the year. Medicare has been a huge blessing, but it definitely is not something that everybody can get onto so easily. And then even once you get Social Security disability, that 2 year wait for Medicare is hard.
It's another thing that could kill you. So, but your insurance company, was it a nationwide company or was it specific to New Mexico?
Oh no, it was a nationwide company, but I think what each state probably has their own policies with different doctors. So I don't know if I was with the same company in Minnesota, if I would have had the same issue. It really kind of depends on the state.
And do you think, like, did you try going to the media and just blasting them in the media? Because we have a lot, you know, being in California, we always have patients who threaten the media as a, you know, as a threat to doctors or hospitals. And they say, okay, if you're not going to do this, I'm just going to contact the media.
And you know, sometimes, older.
Sometimes the threat actually works, because, you know, we're such a scary bunch, us media people. But, you know, like the, I don't know what the expression, the curse of the pen or whatever it's called, you know? So sometimes the threat of media exposure, although, you know, insurance companies aren't, they don't usually buckle to things like that. It's mostly the hospitals and, you know. But, you know, there's all kinds of issues. Like, it's just amazing to me that, you know, there's, like, people always have pet charities where they do fundraising and they do sponsorship and, you know, even pro bono work, like attorneys have to take on pro bono work. We know that hospitals have charity policies where they could help individuals that are struggling financially or in, you know, dire straits, like it sounds like the situation would qualify for. And yet nobody wanted to step up and help you. Do you think it was because you were so young? Or?
I think I probably didn't advocate for myself as well as I could have. If I was a little bit older and I had been through a few more things in life, I might have known better. But I was very young at the time, and I think that I really was going through everything blind. I didn't threaten the media, you know, because I wouldn't have thought about that. And honestly, being so naive. I mean, I hate to keep calling myself that, but I really was. I was very naive of like, what do you mean somebody doesn't want to help me when they're supposed to help me? That doesn't make any sense to my little brain, you know? I didn't understand that the world was quite so harsh in some ways. And I think that with my doctor, I know that he did lower his costs, and he did forgive a lot of the debt that I had with him specifically. But the problem is whenever you go in for surgery, it's not just the one doctor that you're working with. You're working with a separate group of anesthesiologists, and you're working with hospital costs, and you're working with, you know, name something. There's always some random doctor or nurse or somebody that's going to come in from an outside company to draw your blood even, you know, that he has no control over. And I didn't know who to go to ask for other people to forgive debt or help me on a payment plan or whatever. I just went into very significant debt of my own, which ultimately ended in a bankruptcy a few years later because there was nothing I could do. I was so out of everything.
Well, it's just what's really sad to me is, I mean, there's so many healthcare professionals out there that would have been in a position to help you and didn't. Like, you know, financial counselors at the hospital, the people that work at the doctor's office, social workers at hospitals, I mean, occupational therapists. These are the people that are trained. Even the attorney should have found resources for you. It just seems like, you know, you slipped through the cracks in terms of having the support you needed.
Or maybe I didn't ask the right question.
Well,
you know, a lot of
that's their job. Yeah. I mean, they have the experience. Like, as the patient, you shouldn't have to ask the questions. It should be that the providers say, okay, like, for instance, you know, I know about this from various different scenarios, but it's, what's really terrible is it always seems to be the people that are not having the financial issues that get all the services. Like, you know, they sign up for, what do you call that? You know, the drug testing or I forget what it's called. You know, where they put you in a sample of
clinical trials.
Thank you. And, you know, they contact pharmacies and they get samples, or they get the pharmacy to, you know, donate medication that a person needs. You know, they have all these like telethons, you know?
Yeah.
And like I said, it's usually, you know, pet projects that are popular. You know, obviously if there's only 1% in the country, you're talking about something that's going to benefit 3 people versus something that might benefit, you know, 3 million people, right? So you're competing against that. But the professionals in the hospital and the doctor's office should have really taken on more of a responsibility, in my opinion.
Yeah. Well, I could have used you a few years ago then.
I know, really. And the thing is, my background isn't in patient advocacy, but there's certainly like things, stories like this get me riled up. Because, you know, everybody's so focused on the financial aspect of it without really stepping up to say, okay, we have the resources and we're going to help, you know?
Yeah. Well, and that's why I felt like writing the book that I wrote was mandatory. You know, originally it started out just kind of as a journal of like, oh, I need to, you know, keep some information for myself because I was talking to so many different people and I didn't know how to take notes that weren't funny. So I just took funny notes and I labeled everybody with a nut name. So I've got Hazelnut in the book and, you know, Pistachio and all these random people because everybody seems so crazy to me. And it ended up turning into this book. And in the book, I do my best to talk about what went on with me and the things that I learned from it so that other people, you know, if they're going through a similar situation, maybe they'll, you know, react to things a little bit differently or ask some of the questions that I didn't ask. I've got in there a basic checklist for healthcare rights and services. And it's so funny how life kind of throws you curveballs. I wasn't expecting to be some healthcare activist originally. I was just trying to get through my life. But I had the opportunity to send in a blog post to Huffington Post. And, you know, I sent it in like November. It was the basic checklist for healthcare rights. It was the same thing that was in my book. And I didn't hear back from them. So I'm like, whatever. I, you know, forgot about it. And then I think it was like 3 or 4 months later, I got this letter that said, congratulations, your blog's been posted and here's your login for you to post as many other blogs as you want. And so since that time, I've been, you know, posting things that are relevant in the current day and age and trying to stay up on top of what's going on in the discussions about healthcare changes. And I've turned into this mini advocate who gets a lot of phone calls and emails asking what you know, next steps people should take. And it's an interesting place to be coming from someone who, you know, was at one point termed a real victim of the system.
Right. And I mean that, like, it's interesting because I want to talk to you more a little bit about the writing. The book is called The Malformation of Healthcare, and it's available on all the major retailers, including Amazon.com. I want to talk to you about the writing process because, as you know, I'm a writer as well. And that is a whole other topic, but I do want to get into a little bit of specifics. Recently, I wrote an article on this website called nerdwallet.com, and it's a financial website, and it has also a healthcare component where there's some patient advocates who help patients who and consumers having issues with their medical bills. And, you know, I'm learning a lot because I don't see it that much because I work from the provider side. You know, I know that we help our patients who are, you know, treated by the physicians that we represent. But this has sort of opened up a whole extra layer of what's going on really with the consumers. And I actually wrote an article recently called Shopping for Healthcare and Online Dating, which got picked up by a couple of major news outlets. And so that's been very exciting for me.
That's great.
Yeah, it's fun, you know. And then last week I got a CBS interview about my book and about my expertise on CBS Los Angeles on their radio show. So that was really exciting. And I have all that. If anybody wants to read it or listen to it, they can reach it on my blog at SharonHollander.com. We're going to take a short break, and we come back. I want to talk more with Erin Havel about her book, The Malformation of Healthcare.
Doctor, don't you whine, because your cash flow is now a flat line. You can make your income fast. Call 818-907-STAT.
For all your medical billing needs, visit us at www.statmedical.net or call 818-907-7828. That's
818-907-STAT.
You're listening to The Business of Medicine on TalkZone.com. Back to Sharon Hollander.
Good morning. We're talking this morning with Erin Havel, who is an activist for patient advocacy and also the author of the book, The Malformation of Healthcare. And it discusses a young American struggle for survival. She talks about her own personal struggle and gives patients a checklist of, I guess, questions to ask or issues to resolve while they're dealing with their own healthcare issues. Is that correct, Erin?
Yeah, it's a navigation, like, linear thing to follow. Make sure that you know, like, what your out-of-network or benefits are, and just really understand your policy before you even go in for any treatment. Call ahead. It's basics that a lot of people don't think about, and then they end up getting caught in bad situations over.
Well, you know what we find as basics is it's just like, I love when people say things are not rocket science, you know, but you're not doing neurosurgery, but like even once the neurosurgeons know how to do everything, then it's easy for them. Rocket scientists don't worry about it because they, you know, everything's easy once you know how to do it. If you know what questions to ask, then it becomes, you know, it's a tool and it's a resource. And many people don't know what questions to ask. And, or they're not in a situation to ask the questions because they're too sick, you know?
That's right. Yeah. When you're sick, you really don't have a lot of resources for yourself. You know, it's good to always have somebody that can act as your advocate while you're feeling so crummy because you're going to miss something. And it's always good to write everything down. That's, you know, two simple things that you could do just to make your life a little easier.
But, you know, now I don't know if you're up to speed on some of the changes with healthcare, but it's getting worse because now patients are having zero out-of-network benefits. You know, with Obamacare and everything, they're restricting where those patients can seek treatment. And so it's even a more narrow scope. Like if you have a specialist, like your doctor in Denver, who is the only one that is capable of rendering care on a certain illness or disease, like the patients won't have the opportunity to even go see those patients.
Interesting.
I mean, be able to have their insurance. There'll be zero coverage. So they'll either have to pay cash or they'll have to get like what's called a letter of agreement from the insurance to the
is
provider
that for
saying.
Every level of coverage for the bronze.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, that's
platinum.
The whole, yeah, because that's their goal is that's the, you know, like the hook on how they're going to save costs is they're going to eliminate out of network benefits. Well, that's all fine and dandy. You know, but some of the people that have reported that, I have something else funny to tell you. When I was on that radio show, they had a person that's with Consumer Watchdog, mm-hmm. and she started a website called Your Insurance Sucks Because, and patients are all like reporting in on why their insurance sucks. It's kind of funny. Anyway, what was I saying? Oh yeah, so the way that they're going about saving costs, allegedly, is by eliminating out-of-network benefits and basically turning PPO coverage into EPO, which is like exclusive provider organizations, making
sure.
It smaller and smaller and smaller. And I guess there was some guy in New York who got really upset because, I don't know if you've ever been to Manhattan, but it's not easy to go from even a few blocks because of traffic and logistics. Anyway, the only hospital that he could go to was something like, I don't know, 40 miles or 60 miles away from where he lived. Now, how practical is that? It's ridiculous.
Right, right. You know, honestly, there are so many loopholes. And, I mean, even before the whole ACA, you know, took effect, I saw some of the loopholes. So I know that there are a lot of things that insurance companies will do to try to save money and make things work. And I'm not surprised to hear that. It's sad, but it's not surprising, and it's not new. I mean, that kind of stuff has been going on for so long. It's just maybe not as many people talking about it. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like now it's affecting.
Yeah, but now that you've
now
like brought it to a public forum, and now that you know what you do, what you know, I mean, what's the statute of limitations? Why can't you go back after the insurance company now and say, okay, I want reimbursement for all these out-of-pocket expenses?
Oh gosh, can you imagine that fight?
I know, but that would be a fun fight, wouldn't it?
Oh, I don't know. You know, honestly, I don't want to fight with anybody.
I know. I don't like fighting either. But it's like, why should they get away with it? It's sort of like, you know, they have a fiduciary responsibility to cover their members.
Yeah.
And they have deeper pockets, and they shouldn't be allowed to get away with it. It should be like, you should find an attorney with a personal crusade and then go after them.
I mean, and I don't know if you remember, but there was a young adult who had, I believe it was colon cancer or whatever, and he had a Twitter handle, and it was Poop Strong, if I remember correctly. And he was not getting coverage for his treatment, and he actually tweeted the, I believe it was the CEO of one of the big insurance companies, I can't remember which one it was now. And because of his enormous following on Twitter, he actually got a response, and all of a sudden the CEO was working with his own company to make sure that this guy got his cancer treatment. And so,
well, that's what I was saying before about the media, because remember that there was that, I think it was a tornado in Oklahoma, and they had all these little young kids that it was like a school that got desecrated or something.
Okay.
Anyway, there was some kid who, you know, was pinned under some, I don't know, wreckage or something. And the teacher like saved him. And then she cut her leg and she had to go get stitches or something. There was some horrible thing. I don't know. Anyway, you know, this woman was like a hero. She saved this kid's life and she went to her insurance company, like she went to the hospital and then they wouldn't cover it because it wasn't in her network or some crap. Right. And the guy on CNN, whatever his name is, Pierce Morgan, whatever his name is, he got a hold of the story. Ran it on CNN, and guess what? Her insurance ended up covering her.
Yeah.
So the moral of the story is, you know, the media can actually be beneficial in helping with these issues.
Yes, it can. And I think that we're in more of that kind of an area now where people that are off the map can get attention through media. I don't know that it was necessarily like that even 10 or 15 years ago that it was so easy. But now, you know, with the advent of different social networking sites and so on, there really is more opportunity to get noticed. There are also more people trying to get noticed. So there's the
and
other side
like,
of it.
Tell me like a little bit, we just have a few minutes left about your writing process. I mean, you enjoyed the writing process?
I did. You know, it was first book that I've ever done because I was more of a playwright and performer prior to all of this. So writing a book, it was interesting to work with an editor and see how, you know, things move around and how you should say some things and maybe not say some other things, even if they're true, because you don't want to get in trouble, you know, legally.
Right.
You know, so that was an interesting process. Now I've moved on to more whimsical books. I think that being so serious all the time, like I'm very serious with my Huffington Post blog, and you can find that on, if you go on Google and you type in Huffington Post, Erin Havel, you'll find all of my articles. And I can be serious there. But on another side, you know, I've started writing a few books that are just lighter. So I've got a young adult book series that I'm working on called The Traveler's Coin. And then I've got two adult fantasy fiction books. One's The Guided series, and the second is currently working title is Star Beings, and it's going to be a whole, you know, series on that. And that's more like I can look up some historical interesting facts and try to pull those into, you know, a fun fictional story. It gives me a little bit of a lightness instead of always being so focused on the advocacy work, because that can get very draining very quickly.
Right. And so if patients want, or anybody, consumers, my listeners, anybody wants to get in touch with you, what's the best way to do that?
Absolutely. I have a website. It's erinhavel.com. And if they have any emails or questions they want to ask me, my email is info@erinhavel.com. So info@erinhavel.com. Really easy. And I'm happy to answer any questions or continue a dialogue if anybody has anything they want to talk about.
And so how are you feeling now?
You know, it's rough. I'm on a daily chemotherapy drug, so I struggle with some things, but I'm doing the best I can, and I think that's all anybody can do. So I'm working through my life.
Yeah. One day at a time, as they say, right?
Yeah.
And then, so your long-term, like you do speaking engagements as well?
Yeah, I for a while there, I was doing a bunch of speaking engagements, and I haven't been asked recently, so we'll see. I'm kind of in hibernation with writing all these books, so maybe after those are out a little bit, I'll be in more speaking. I've been doing a few of these radio kind of shows, and that's been very good. It's been nice for the book, and it's been nice for me to talk to people that really are struggling with the same kinds of things that I have struggled with.
Well, it's very important for somebody to know that there's patient advocates out there that can assist patients with these huge issues and not have to go it alone. It's like, I know in one of your comments you said it was like David going after Goliath. Like you're the little peon, and there's this huge insurance company, and it's very intimidating.
Very, very.
Anyway, I want to thank you very much today for being our guest, and you've given us some great information, and I'm looking forward to talking about your book because I haven't finished it. I started it, and I'm really loving it. Once again, the book name is called The Malformation of Healthcare, and it's available on all major retailers. Anyway, thank you for being our guest today, and thank you guys for listening, and I look forward to future shows. You're listening to Sharon Hollander on TalkZone.com.